say with the document that carried forward from the agreements of 1972, they planned for the continuing reduction in strategic arms of the United States and the Soviet Union. And there are many versions running loose as to why this is so. One says that the Soviet bargainers were simply too tough for our side to accept. Another, more political, is that we became suddenly too tough for reasons, according to one version, related to our military requirements, or for reasons, according to another version, unrelated to our military requirements, namely the paralysis Watergate has visited on the president. If he had come back with any agreement, so this version goes, the hawks would have found it too soft, the doves too tough. What isn't clear is what it is that we should ideally achieve in the next phase of our assault to liberations. But quite unexpectedly, just before Mr. Nixon went to Russia, a critical figure in the salt picture resigned his office. Mr. Paul Henry Nitzer was the Pentagon's representative to the U.S. delegation handling salt. He spoke only very briefly on his resignation and rather enigmatically about his withdrawal, but seemed to be saying that domestic American considerations had got in the way of a focused concentration on American military requirements. Mr. Nitzer, an investment banker by profession, has for years been involved in the defense establishment, including as Secretary of the Navy for President Lyndon Johnson, before that as Director of Policy Planning for the State Department, and subsequently as Deputy Secretary of Defense in the last years of Mr. Johnson. Until a few weeks ago, Elmo Russell Zumwalt was the Chief of Naval Operations, the youngest in American history. He was appointed by President Nixon and in due course revolutionized the Navy. He has said of himself that some people think of him as a drooling fang militarist, others as a bleeding heart liberal. It is his nightmare that he has succeeded in creating a successful, integrated, modern, uniformed, non-sexist Navy, trained to lose all future wars. I should like to begin by asking Ms. Nitzer, is it your opinion that President Nixon cannot negotiate a desirable SALT II because he is president, or because the Russians are communists, or a combination of the two?
I'd say it was a combination of the two. In the first place, the Russians are very difficult to negotiate with. I think it takes great clarity and really almost perfect coordination on the part of U.S. negotiators at various levels to achieve the type of arms control agreements which would be useful to the United States. Furthermore, it seems to me that those who have been responsible in a position of responsibility for the security of the United States, particularly the Secretaries of Defense, have been more deeply interested in achieving balanced and effective arms control agreements than anyone else in the U.S. government. They want to relieve the defense threat to the United States. Now, the Russians have been obdurate. They are difficult to negotiate with. But one of the things that they take into account is what they call the correlation of forces. And I think they do, in looking at the correlation of forces, estimate what the strength, the internal political strength of the United States is. And I think it is without doubt that the Watergate affair has weakened the presidency and therefore has made it more difficult for us to achieve the kind of agreements which we really should have.
Well, now, translated into the kind of impact your analysis would have on the strategic planners in the Soviet Union, it would run how? Would it run as follows, that any agreement they made with President Nixon would likely be repudiated by his successor, who could be anticipated to be more hawkish than he? Or might they not reason to the contrary, namely that the weakness of Mr. Nixon is the weakness most likely exploitable by the American left, and that under the circumstances, any concessions made by Mr. Nixon, made to Mr. Nixon at this point, could be maximized in dealing with a future administration?
No, I think it is other than that. I think the Soviet strategy, by and large, would be to try to make a series of piecemeal agreements and avoid making the type of comprehensive, long-term, balanced, and equal agreement which the United States has sought and which would be to the interest of the United States. Now, I don't think that the Soviets believe that Mr. Nixon would enter into an agreement which the Congress would not ratify or that would be upset by his successors. I think rather they feel that it is not necessary for them to negotiate the kind of an agreement which would be to the interest of the United States.
Because if they, because their interests lie in what? In dealing with a successor who is himself demoralized by the trauma of Mr. Nixon's deposition and under the circumstances would be greedier for something ostensibly.
I think that misses the point. That I was trying to make.
Would you explain why I missed the point?
Because as I said earlier, I think it is to the interest of the United States to negotiate a comprehensive, effective, and balanced long-term agreement controlling strategic arms. I think it is to the Soviet interest not to do that, but to negotiate a series of piecemeal agreements which will not have the effect of really relieving the defense problem of the United States. I think they feel that Mr. Nixon was not in a position really to support the type of agreement which the United States really, which is in the United States' interest. That it was to his interest to maintain the appearance of détente, and that therefore he would go along with partial agreements rather than the Soviets being forced to address themselves to a comprehensive long-term agreement.
And when you speak of their being forced, you're referring to their being forced in response to what kind of pressures?
To the whole series of pressures that bear upon a negotiation of this kind. And among those considerations, rather, are the state of the world's economy, the state of the correlation of military forces between the two sides, and the degree to which there is political support in the United States for the presidency.
Well, in your deliberations in planning for these sessions, did you feel that you disposed of pressures that were extra military in character? I mean, did you feel that you might entice the Soviet Union by economic credit, for instance? Was this a part of your portfolio?
No, it was not.
Ought it to have been?
No, I don't think so. But our task was to negotiate arms control agreements, and simply in that ambiente, simply in that context of negotiating arms control agreements with the Soviet Union. However, the possibility of success in that does depend upon a great many other things outside the negotiation.
Which you, of course, felt free to attempt to coordinate, even though you couldn't yourself describe them.
No, that was not the task of the delegation.
I see.
That really is the task of the President, Secretary of State, and National Security Council.
Well, let me ask you, Admiral Zumwalt, if I may. The emphasis has been on the word strategic, arms limitations. And yet you are, I guess, at this point, the most conspicuous critic, at least of naval disarmament. Do you sharply distinguish between naval disarmament that is strategic in character and naval disarmament that is tactical in character?
No, I think they're all part of the same general problem. And I would point out, Bill, that the primary reason that there's been more publicity concerning my views with regard to the naval balance than with regard to the strategic balance is the result of the fact that it was possible to speak on the one and not on the other. While delicate negotiations were going on in the strategic arms limitation field, not only prudence but policy required that there not be public discussion of it. We're now at a phase where it is feasible.
Well, if as I understand it, it is extremely difficult, for instance, in facing up to concrete situations that normally would require reliance on tactical resources to proceed without some reference to your strategic cover. Is that correct? So that they could come back from Salt 2 and present you with a situation that would make your any hypothetical tactical challenge an easy one to cope with, or one that would make it impossible to cope with. Is that correct?
The formulation that I like is that in the strategic field, it's gotten increasingly more dangerous for either side to consider the use of strategic weapons. And the advantage that the United States had for many years in the strategic field has been eroded and is in the process of being overtaken, and the Soviets are en route to strategic superiority. In that environment, it becomes even more worrisome that we are in the non-strategic field in an era where we have fallen behind the Soviet Union with regard to our maritime capability. Behind in this sense. We have a much tougher naval mission than they do because we've got to use the seas. They merely have to cut our sea line. The odds are that we cannot do our job. The odds are that they can do theirs in a conventional war.
Well, when the negotiators went out to negotiate SALT II, their mandate, as you understand it, was what? To effect a harmonious and symmetrical reduction of such a kind as would not affect your tactical resources.
I think that their mission was a very clear one and a proper one of offering to the Soviet Union, one of the two superpowers, a power which has only half of our gross national product, essential equivalence. In other words, we were offering them a very good thing, equivalence with ourselves in the strategic field, although they couldn't afford it in the strict sense in a competitive race. And that task was given to a group of very professional negotiators, and I think it's a shame that the subsequent course of events in this country has not made it possible for them to complete their assignment.
Well, using the terminology of Mr. Nitzer, the long-term versus the piecemeal, you would classify SALT I as which of the two, piecemeal or strategic or long-run?
I think SALT I was clearly the best piecemeal effort we could get. Would you agree with that?
Well, just to expand on that, SALT I dealt primarily with the control of defensive strategic weapons, ABMs.
Sure.
And that was a long-run treaty. It was a treaty of indefinite duration, so that half the problem was successfully handled during SALT I, the ABM, the defensive part of it, on a long-term basis. The interim agreement was supposed to buy enough time under favorable conditions for us to duplicate that in the offensive season and negotiate a long-term comprehensive offensive agreement which would parallel the ABM treaty.
I think that one important additional point there is that we had an advantage over the Soviets in the defensive area, and therefore they were willing to accept a long-term solution which involved parity.
You mean because our ABM technology was better than theirs?
That's right. Uh-huh. In the offensive side, where it was not nearly so clear that we had that kind of an advantage, we were not able to get that kind of a deal.
Well, are you in situations like this working with a model in mind, a paradigm? If there were a plenipotentiary who suddenly found himself in total charge of the Soviet and the American arsenal, is it obvious what we would want that plenipotentiary to do?
I think so.
Is it? What would you describe roughly what would be the ideal situation?
I think the ideal situation would be one, first of all, which would carry out what Admiral Zumwalt has said, and that is essential equivalence between the two sides and the capability of their strategic forces. Secondly, that those forces...
Could you give an illustration?
Well, that the number of launchers on both sides might be equal, that the rear throw weight might be equal, that the destructive capability of the overall forces might be equal.
In quality, or in balance in some way with quantity, or
taking into account both quantity and quality.
Now, equal is defined as at any level, or equal at a level that is greater than that of the third ranking.
I was going to make a second point. And the second point was that the limitation should be so designed as to increase the stability of the relationship between them. In other words, to reduce any possible temptation to initiate a nuclear war in a time of crisis. And thirdly, that the bases should be laid for reducing the resources put into the strategic effort of both sides. To carry on with your point about reductions, it would be better, for instance, if there were reductions to a mutually agreed ceiling than if the U.S. were to have to build up to the larger numbers, the larger capability of individual missiles, which the Soviet side now is about to have.
Well, he has rather subtract from the preponderant power than add to the subordinate
power. Exactly.
Now, but there comes presumably a level at which this is imprudent, right, if you think, say, below the offensive potential of China.
I think that's quite right. Yeah. I think there is a minimum level below which one should not go, and it becomes more unstable if one goes too low. But it's certainly, it would be better to have both sides to come down to something approximating the levels which we now plan to have, rather than for the United States, in order to maintain equivalence, to go up to the levels of the Soviet Union.
But are you suggesting that we are left with no alternative than to do that in absent this agreement?
I wouldn't say that we have no alternative, but I would say that it is important, I believe, that there be parity, there be essential equivalence, roughly equal on both sides. And I don't see how one can do that unless either the Soviet side comes down or we go up.
And what do you consider the principal sticking point at this moment? What is it that the Soviet Union wants most not to give up, which we want most for it to give up?
I would say it's the option to have strategic superiority that they want not to give up.
You agree?
I agree.
And this strategic superiority, is it, to use a military man, interpretable as something that is simply a reflection of ideological machismo, or is it something which is a part of a highly meditated military strategy, the effect of which could be the neutralization of American policy?
I think it's the latter. I think it goes back to what Mr. Nitze suggested was their basic view of the correlation of forces. I think they see in the SALT negotiations, as their concept of what they should achieve, a situation in which they are permitted to maintain this gradual shift of strategic balance in their favor as part of that shifting correlation of forces that ensures that the irreversibility of détente is their kind of détente, not the kind that any American would like to see.
Well, do you believe that the Soviet planners, in making their reckonings, intelligently inform themselves about American public mood and about possible emotional lurches in American policy, or are they so unaccustomed to a phenomenon of that kind that they tend to disregard it?
They're working terribly hard at the problem of improving their understanding of the American political scene. They have an institute which devotes itself entirely to the study of the United States.
I know, yeah.
I think their evaluations of the United States are much better today than they used to be. I still think that they have some difficulty at really putting themselves into the U.S. mind. I think every country tends to some extent to attribute to another country processes of thought similar to those
yes.
that one is used to. So that even though they're working very hard at it, I don't think that they yet have a 100% evaluation of the American political scene.
Well, now, the Arbatov Institute, which, as I understand it, has the job of instructing Soviet policymakers about American life, American mood, the impact of American political developments, might theoretically be saying to them, watch out for what? What do they think conceivably might be stirring in America, which when gestated could cause the people to rush to Congress and into the White House, people who would constitute a genuine threat to Soviet aspirations, licit and illicit?
I think that they understand this sufficiently well. They are probably cautioning the Soviet leadership to be very gradualistic with regard to their foreign policy changes and not to take those actions which are so precipitate that they do create that shock effect in this country to which you refer, but rather...
Would that deter them, for instance, from overrunning Yugoslavia, Tito died, that kind of thing?
I think that with regard to Yugoslavia, they're likelier to make that judgment based on how they think it will play out within the Warsaw Pact itself, although they'll be somewhat more constrained by U.S. interests. A better example, I think, would be their willingness to step right up to the brink in the recent Yom Kippur War, but having accomplished their aims to a considerable extent, including the achievement of the tripling of oil prices and the temporary embargo, to step away and allow the Americans time to get used to that change in the correlation of forces before another bite.
Well, they don't then, so far as you know, they don't see anything on the American political horizon to be frightened by, in the sense that, for instance, they might have been frightened by the direction that Harry Truman's speeches began taking in 1946 and 1947.
Perhaps the inscrutable Occidental mind might frighten them a bit.
I don't get the impression that they're frightened. I get the impression that they are cautious. Which, you know, if I were advising them, I would advise them the same way. That when there is a movement which is they consider to be in their direction, in their favor, in the correlation of forces in the world, then one should play down any boasting thereof or exacerbation of it. Public exacerbation of it. In the days when they really did have concerns as to the relationship of strategic power between the Soviet Union and ourselves, in those days, Mr. Khrushchev used to boast of the power of his nuclear weapons. You remember, he used to say that we three of our weapons could destroy the United Kingdom. We could burn down the olive groves in Greece and things of that kind.
That was during the missile gap, right?
No, that was afterwards, just before the Cuban Missile Crisis, as I remember. But after that, when they really addressed themselves to reversing the inferiority which they then
had. They were very quiet about it.
They've been very quiet about it.
Uh-huh. Well, let me ask you this now that you are no longer constrained, not that you were ever terribly constrained, by your formal offices. Is there anything, in your opinion, that the Soviet Union might do in Europe short of marching into Paris that would significantly mobilize America back into the old spirit of containment? Or is our experience in Vietnam, has that permanently emasculated us as a result, in respect of what we used to call the Cold War confrontation and so on?
Well, my view is that the Soviets perceive that the linkage between conventional forces and strategic nuclear forces is so close with regard to our NATO alliance that that's the worst possible place for them to have a confrontation and has the least likelihood of payoff. I think, therefore, they're much likelier to concentrate on further improvements as they look at improvements in the Middle East and in South Asia and in the Western Pacific area, with priority going to the Middle East because of the fact that they recognize so clearly that that's the jugular of the free world, reliant as we are on its oil.
Well, suppose, and I hope you don't mind my making these situations concrete, mm-hmm. because I think it's easier to explain these things a posteriori. Suppose they set up some sort of a fake government in Iraq, which I shouldn't think would be the hardest thing to do. Which government pleaded or invoked the Brezhnev doctrine and asked for Soviet military help. In your judgment, if we were to say today that that would not be tolerated, would we have the military force to say so convincingly in that part of the world?
In my judgment, the answer to that is that we do not have the conventional military capability to back up our demand that they behave themselves in that area. We might very well make the demand.
Well, is a crisis of that kind something that is or is not considered in the SALT context, or is it too particular?
No, that kind of thing isn't considered in the SALT context at all. Frankly, I think your example is a highly unlikely example, but you were advancing it, I take it, only as an example. But to go back to the SALT context, both sides have tried to isolate the SALT negotiations to the best of their ability from all the outside political crises of the moment. For instance, during the Cambodian crisis, it was mentioned only once and very minorly. It did not impinge upon any of our negotiations. I can think of no immediate tactical thing which was permitted really to interfere with the seriousness of the negotiations between both sides.
Well, assuming a success then at the strategic level, would we not then be reduced for the maintenance of the peace of the world, as we understand it, to our tactical reserves? Assuming a total success in SALT negotiations.
I think that's right.
And this is where you are primarily concerned, am I correct?
It's a crudity to make this parallelism, but in a sense, the strategic business becomes like poison gas. If you achieve true essential equivalence, both sides are, I think, truly deterred from the use, and then one has to consider whether policy gets enforced at lower levels. And if national interests require it to be done, one, particularly when you are that country which is dedicated to the preservation of a stable world order and community, has to be sure that you have the military capability to back up a Pacific foreign policy. And it's that aspect of the problem that has caused me great concern.
Well, with the emphasis that you've put on aircraft carriers, of which we have how many? 25?
We had 24 just 5 years ago. We're down to 15, and we're headed for a lower number.
Uh-huh. And the Soviet Union has had none, right?
They launched about a year ago their first.
Their first. Do they have plans to launch a second?
They started the construction of a second, and in my judgment, we'll have a larger number of aircraft carriers than we do in your hopefully long lifetime.
So it looks as though they have belatedly recognized the importance of the aircraft carrier.
I would state it this way, Bill. They came from behind.
Yeah.
They did those things first that needed to be done first.
Mm-hmm.
First, submarines, a massive submarine fleet, three times the size of our own, now 2.5 times. They next got naval aircraft with cruise missiles on them and surface ships with cruise missiles on them. Having done that and having achieved a creditable capability to cut our sea lines, they're now working on the last part of the acquisition of maritime power, the capability to project it overseas, and for that they must have aircraft carriers.
Yes, but they must also, I take it, have a doctrine, mustn't they? If we agree that nuclear arms are going to become as poison gas became by mutual agreement unusable, then the purpose...
That's our objective in getting equal.
Yes, that's our objective. But assuming that we...
Not necessarily theirs.
Assuming that we achieve this, but we then nevertheless see them continuing to use resources scarcer to them than to us to build up a tremendous tactical capability, it is presumably in order to further a doctrine. Now, I gave an example involving Yugoslavia, which you didn't like much, and gave one involving Iran, which you didn't like very much. But you talk airily about the Western Pacific and the Middle East and so on and so forth. What is What is the describable nature of what it is that they would do with an unanswerable tactical force under a neutralized atomic situation?
Well, Mr. Brezhnev is telling us that in the speeches that he's giving to the communist leadership, which have been published in the Western press, although he doesn't publicly say this, and that is that, look, fellas, we need their technology, we need their agriculture, you're going to hear, therefore, talk of detente. Meanwhile, we're building all of the military hardware we need, so that by the 80s we'll be in a position to turn this thing around, and you will then see a much more aggressive foreign policy. It's all part of a plan to maintain the correlation of forces shifting in their direction through the use of detente and the acquisition of greater military capability. Now, whether or not his successors ever decide to exercise that option depends on whether or not we in the United States do our share to make sure that we maintain the military capability we need. At the present time, we're not doing it.
Well, it goes beyond maintaining the military capability, doesn't it? We certainly had the military capability to win the Vietnamese War and didn't use it. It's a combination of the two, isn't it?
Of course.
Now, is it...